From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. From top rival to top aide, this morning President-elect Barack Obama unveiled his national security team. He nominated one-time Democratic rival Hillary Clinton as his Secretary of State. He also announced others to key posts, including two African-American nominees. To give us some more perspective, we got NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Farai. Good to be with you.
Great to be with you, too. So the big news was the nomination of Senator Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State following weeks of speculation. Let's listen to a little bit about Mr. Obama speaking about his one-time political foe.
I have known Hillary Clinton as a friend, a colleague, a source of counsel, and a tough campaign opponent. She possesses an extraordinary intelligence and a remarkable work ethic. I am proud that she will be our next Secretary of State.
Now, those are some very nice words, and they were not always quite so nice to each other during the campaign. That's normal, but what do you make of their relationship? If this nomination goes through, what do you think their interactions will be? Equals? Still a bit of rivalry? Conciliatory?
I think the rivalry will fade, although obviously it will never be forgotten. Hillary Clinton was quite convinced this was her turn to be president. She ran for the job. She did almost everything right. Some very small mistakes that her campaign made, in retrospect, turned out to be fatal, not emphasizing the caucus states, what have you. But in the end, she didn't win, although she came very close, 18 million votes. She was just a few delegates behind. And so it is a great deal for her to swallow to say, now I am going to serve this man who defeated me. But I think she is a large enough person to do it. And I think she certainly realizes that the best thing for her to do now, for history and for her future and for women who have looked to her for leadership, is to step into this new job and do as well as she possibly can to serve the foreign policy interests and needs of the United States and the Obama administration. And I think they'll have that in common, and that will be the basis of their new relationship.
There were several other people named. I'm going to talk about just two of them and get your perspective. Robert Gates is Secretary of Defense under the current Republican president, but he's also the nominee for the Obama administration. Is that unusual?
Yes, it's unusual to keep the defense secretary. It's a key position. It's one of the four in the inner cabinet, the original cabinet of Treasury Secretary of War, and then later Defense Secretary, Attorney General, and Secretary of State. This is a big job, and you are running the biggest, most visible part of the federal bureaucracy, that is the Pentagon and all the armed services. And Bob Gates has done such a job of it in the last year or so as he has tried to deal with all the wreckage of Donald Rumsfeld's time as Secretary of Defense. And I mean that in the sense not only of policy, Iraq, what have you, but also in the sense of the relationships within the Pentagon, which have been rarely worse than they were during the Rumsfeld years. And so Bob Gates had a big job. He has handled it well. He has been applauded almost universally and certainly across the aisle, bipartisan fashion in Congress. So he provides some continuity, and I think he's also going to surprise a lot of people with his willingness to shift his priorities measurably, substantially, in order to serve his new boss, in order to serve a new set of policy imperatives that are going to come down to him from the rest of this foreign policy team we saw on stage today.
Give me just a quick bit on Susan Rice. She's been nominated as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Who is she?
Susan Rice is a far less high-profile figure than the others who were on the stage today, which that group included senators and governors and so on, people who have been very visible in Washington. Susan Rice has not been a stranger to Washington. Now, she was on the National Security Council of President Bill Clinton. She was Assistant Secretary of State for a period of time under President Clinton. And, of course, most recently, she has been a key foreign policy, really the first foreign policy advisor for the Barack Obama campaign. So he is rewarding her with this highly visible international position of being the permanent U.S. representative to the United Nations. We also call it UN ambassador.
Now, when you look ahead at the challenges that the U.S. faces, including certainly over the past few days, we've been looking at the question of terrorism in the India-Pakistan region with the attacks in Mumbai. Can this group of people speak with one voice to the president?
No. I don't believe any group of people that is this varied and various and also high-powered and individually ambitious could ever speak with just one voice. We've got to throw Joe Biden into the mix here, the vice president. He's been the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and certainly considers himself to be a lifelong and world-class foreign policy expert. We have to include him in this mix. And then also let's include Eric Holder, the new attorney general, because in this age of terrorism, one of the biggest parts, the biggest focus of the attorney general's job has recently been trying to battle terrorism in the United States and prevent another 9/11. So all of these people come from terribly different backgrounds. They bring different expertise, and they're not going to speak with one voice to the president. The real question will be, after the president has made his decision, can they all speak in one voice to support the president and defend his decisions?
Well, Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Farai.
Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor, and he joined me from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Shoppers hit the malls, but is that enough to let retailers deck the halls? With us to forgive me for my bad poetry and, more importantly, sort out the economic news of the day, we've got Bill Spriggs. He's the chair of Howard University's Department of Economics. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for having me, and congrats on your mention in Essence as one of the top 25 movers and shakers.
Oh, well, thank you. I very much appreciate that. Let's talk big picture first. We're in a recession, and it started a year ago. That's according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, and they say that we went into a recession in December of 2007. So why are we just getting confirmation now?
Well, it takes them a while to analyze the data. They, in the past, waited until we had negative growth, but I think they're realizing that what may be more important is to look at the growth of wages. And wages, the total wage bill in the United States has been flat since 2007. If you look back at the 2001 downturn, the total wage bill in the United States was flat for 2001, 2002, and 2003. So I think they have timed it about right.
All right. So some analysts said that shops wouldn't get much traction on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. What actually happened?
Well, it looks like Black Friday turned out better than what many of us thought would happen. Shoppers did show up. They responded to the very deep discounts that retailers offered that day. The big question will be for troubled retailers whether they got enough sales and enough profit, more important than sales, to carry them over into the next year. There were several retailers that were having problems because of the credit crunch and getting working capital to let them survive till consumption returned to normal. And we'll have to see whether they did well enough. The other thing that we have to think about is that retailers already signaled they weren't going to hire new people. We're only a couple of days away from Christmas now, and so that means we're not going to get the bump up in employment we would have anticipated. So this week when we get the employment numbers, and then we will look in January to what the employment numbers look like in December, I think they're going to be much lower than what would have been typical.
Now, let's go to the bailout. The rescue plan keeps evolving, and now we're talking about $200 billion being used to tackle things like credit cards and student loans. How would that work?
Well, what the Federal Reserve is going to do, as opposed to the Treasury, is allow the banks to sell them these bonds. Credit card debt is bundled, just like the mortgage debt had been bundled. And the banks are going to sell those bonds. It's similar to what the Fed would normally do if it wanted to increase the money supply, where they put money into the hands of banks to make the banks more liquid. The idea being that banks would then be able to extend credit to consumers again, though given where consumers are in their balance sheets, the amount of debt they have run up, the drop in their home values, the drop in their savings, I don't think consumers are going to be in the mood to take on new debt.
What about printing more money? A lot of these remedies involve making the part of what we do in this country, making ourselves people who can deal with money that is devalued a bit. I guess my question is, I think about places like Zimbabwe, which is why I'm having a hard time phrasing the question. People say, okay, the currency is worthless because the government printed too much of it. I know we're not in that kind of a situation, but in opening ourselves up to loosen up the U.S. dollar to provide more currency, is the U.S. taking a huge risk?
Well, normally you fear that because of inflationary pressure. So a country like Zimbabwe, people don't want to hold the currency because inflation is at such a fast pace that the next day it appears that the currency is worthless. What we're currently fearing in the United States is not inflation, but actually deflation. We're afraid that the next day prices will continue to fall so that you may, in fact, want to hold dollars. You just won't want to make investments. So we want to put more currency into the situation so that banks will be liquid and able to make loans. We don't want to worry about inflation at this point.
All right. Bill Spriggs, thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Spriggs is the chair of Howard University's Department of Economics, and he joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. For decades, the big three auto companies have been an integral part of the U.S. economy. Now those companies are struggling to survive and pleading for a federal bailout. General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler have until Tuesday to submit a restructuring plan to Congress. For more, we've got Jerome Vaughn. He's the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan. Jerome, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
So what we've been hearing a lot about is basically just a failure of these negotiations to move forward. Before we get to the nuts and bolts of it from an economic level, how are people in Detroit dealing with what appears to be a reluctance on the part of the federal government to really enter into a bailout?
Well, I think there are really two key emotions that are at play in Detroit right now. One is fear. People are very scared because the auto industry is so important to Metro Detroit. Thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs. If one or more of the automakers were to go under, the ripple effect here would be catastrophic because the plant is affected and then the suppliers are affected and the restaurants are affected and the shopping malls are affected. So it would be such a horrible cascading effect. So fear is number one. And I think number two is anger. People see how roughly the automakers were treated and people feel that they were being treated as auto workers roughly as well, when at the same time you see, you know, on a Sunday night, Citibank gets $20 billion without a second thought. So people here are very angry about the different treatments Wall Street and the automakers have received.
Let's go into some of the ongoing plans. The General Motors Board put their heads together yesterday and worked on a restructuring plan. Do we know anything about what they were talking about?
We don't have a lot of details because the automakers aren't really interested in giving too much away early. But there are a few things that we can really surmise that are in there because Congress was really adamant about a few things. One was fuel economy standards. Congress was really hammering. They wanted better fuel economy standards. They wanted the automakers to pull back on their opposition to those fuel economy standards getting better. And there was a whole political bit of intrigue last week and the week before as well. John Dingell was taken off of a key committee. He's always been a supporter of the auto industry. And in his place will be Congressman Waxman from California, who's very much a supporter of higher auto industry standards for CAFE. So that's part one. compensation for the executives is expected to be cut in some form or another. That was something Congress was very adamant about, saying how can, you know, the profits be dropping so horribly when at the same time the executives are making millions and millions and millions of dollars. And then also when the executives testified, they really showed a reluctance to work for a dollar a year, with the exception of Bob Nardelli. So those are a couple of things we know are going to be in there, as well as plans for continuing to pare back and make the auto industry more competitive on a global basis. So those are things we're expecting to see tomorrow.
All right. What about the UAW, the union? Ron Gettelfinger says the union is going to be willing to renegotiate somewhat to help this whole push for federal loans. What kind of concessions could you see from the auto workers union?
Well, I think Ron Gettelfinger is in a very hard place these days because he wants to represent his members, but at the same time, he realized the automakers are in such a precarious position. He's going to lose a lot of members and a lot of members' jobs if this isn't handled well. So I would expect some pulling back on wages. Also, the elimination of the jobs bank, that was something that really pushed the buttons of Congress. They were really upset that here are these workers, they're getting paid 90% of their salary, even though they're not doing any work. Those numbers have come down dramatically over the past few years. There is only several hundred people in the jobs bank now, as opposed to thousands in years before. But that was something that still really upset Congress. I think the other thing that we're going to look at is how healthcare costs for retirees are going to be paid and managed. There's this new deal that came out where GM and Ford and Chrysler are going to pay into a trust fund. Some of those details might be reconfigured a bit to make it a little more palatable to the automakers.
All right. The Center for Automotive Research, a Michigan-based think tank, estimates that if the automakers shut down half of their manufacturing capacity, 2.5 million people could lose their jobs. So put that in context for me. Compared to losses so far over time in the Detroit area in particular, is this far vaster than anything we've ever seen?
Yes. I mean, I think the only thing that would be comparable would be really going back to the Great Depression when, you know, many auto companies went out of business. There were at times, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of automakers here in Detroit back in the 20s and 30s, and many of them closed during the Depression. Unemployment skyrocketed. And I think we're looking at that sort of eventuality now if one of the automakers goes under. It's going to be ugly, not just for Metro Detroit, but for the rest of the country, because, you know, there's going to be a huge ripple effect for the rest of the country.
There are some unusual requests or proposals on the table. I was reading the blog of Seth Godin the other day. He's kind of a marketing guru who comes out with a lot of books and has a new one coming up and gives a lot of speeches at influential technology conferences. And his argument was, instead of just helping the automakers that exist, create an environment where people might be willing to create new auto companies, upstarts that would then have technological innovation. I haven't really heard a lot of other people push for that. Is there any question of whether or not rivals could emerge during this tough time for the big three?
Rivals might be too strong a word, but I think there's definitely the possibility of some entrepreneurship that could happen. There could be smaller automakers that come up and start making cars. I think the problem overall economically is nobody coming up is going to replace GM or Ford or Chrysler. I mean, the volume there is immense. You know, the efficiencies of scale, while not perfect, are much better than a startup is going to be. You know, they're responsible, you know, for, you know, 50% of the cars sold in the U.S. right now. Is a startup or two going to make a dent in that? No, not for some time. And we've seen startups from other countries come in, sell, you know, thousands of cars, but not millions. So that's probably not a viable response that's going to save the situation economically.
So right now we're looking at the car companies going back to Congress tomorrow with restructuring plans. What do we know about their approach? Last time they were criticized for flying on corporate jets. In terms of style and in terms of substance, what can we expect?
Well, I think that's something that really shocked the automakers that they were taken to task for coming in private jets. So however they get there, it's going to be much lower key. We know that some of the automakers may be driving, some may be flying commercial. But part of what's happened was immediately after that, the thought was, well, let's have a huge caravan. We'll have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cars coming from all across the Midwest going to Washington, D.C. That was the immediate response. Then that was dialed back a little bit, and they kind of realized, well, they'd probably take a hit on that too, you know, wasting a lot of gas and creating a lot of pollution. So they didn't want to go with that response either. So what they're going to do, they're going to have a news conference tomorrow where they're going to talk about the economic impact on every state in the union, represented by people from each state of the union, where they'll talk about the auto industry impact, the number of jobs that might be lost if, you know, one of the automakers went under. So that's really going to be their approach on a PR level. And I think, you know, they're really getting their ducks in a row for tomorrow because they saw how harsh the questioning was the first time around. They're going to be better prepared for tomorrow.
All right, Jerome, thanks.
My pleasure.
Jerome Vaughn is the news program director for WDET in Detroit, Michigan. He spoke to us from their studios. We've been talking about one industry, the auto business, and now we're going to talk to one man at an economic crossroads. James Smith lives in Southern California. He was working in a plant assembling lawn sprinklers up until September when he was laid off. James, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. You know, you got in touch with us through an outreach that we put on our blog, and we were really moved by what you had to say, but also just the clarity with which you said it. And it had so much to do with your desire to be a husband, earning money, and living some form of the American dream. So let's break down a little bit more where things have gone for you. So you were working for a plant that was assembling lawn sprinklers. What did they tell you about your job and when?
Well, they actually told me earlier that month that we would be laid off for December and that we would return to work in January. It was actually a temporary job, but I was on track to become a permanent employee. And a week later, they came in and said, we no longer need you and we'll see what happens in January.
So you had no time to really get comfortable in that job?
I'd been there for a year.
I see. Okay. So it was in September, though, that they told you that they were going to have to let people go in December?
Right. That we were going to be leaving in December, but we would be coming back.
Right. What are the signs now?
Truth be told, I'm terrified. I don't think we're coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Building is down drastically in this country right now. And if there are no buildings, there are no need for landscape fixtures.
Right. So when will you find out?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea at this point.
You're just waiting for a call.
Any call from anyone, anywhere.
So are you actively out looking for something else more stable?
On a daily basis.
What are you finding?
Finding nothing. Even the jobs that supposedly no one wants are being filled by PhDs, basically.
Yeah. Now, you've had some tough moments in your life before. You ended up out of the Marine Corps going into addiction and then going into prison as well. So tell me about how you think some of the things that you went through affected you for better and worse. And what I mean was, you've already been through an incredible journey to pull your life to where it is now. At the same time, doesn't it hurt you when you go for jobs to have a record?
It hurts me in a number of different ways. One, you know, legally, I guess no one can be honest about it. When I go into an interview and I tell them that I've been to prison, and I ask them with all due sincerity, please, is this going to affect me? And they say no. And I know I'm qualified and a lot of times overqualified for the positions. And I don't get a call back, or I call back and they just won't talk to me at all. It hurts financially. It hurts emotionally. I feel that I'm no longer even an American citizen. I'm unworthy in a way.
Does it also hurt that you are someone who's served the country, you know, in the military, and that you're in this position? I mean, do you think there, who do you, it sounds like you've taken a lot of responsibility in trying to get out there and take care of yourself, but also do you think there's anyone else who could be of more help or who should be of more help to you?
You know, I would love to say that I know who should be of help, but I don't. I understand how people feel. I understand I've committed a crime, and I don't expect full trust, but I mean, as a former Marine, I feel as though I've been labeled traitor, and I don't know who to ask for help. I go to the different organizations, and they say that they give me advice on how to get a job and send me back out, and it's, you know, I've been out there.
What about your wife? You're married, and so is she trying to encourage you?
She's trying to. She's trying to, and I don't know if she does it intentionally or not, but every now and then she'll say something that just hits straight to the bone, and I think it's me. I think I'm just becoming a little sensitive and a little tender about it now.
Do you think that, do you have, and I know this is a delicate question, do you have it in you to deal with this for another month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, however long it takes?
Well, actually, I'm falling back on military training, and the fact is that I have no choice, and therefore it will be.
So you're just going to tough it out?
I have no other choice.
What if you end up without a home again?
Then I will be homeless. I've been considering taking what little money I have and expatriating.
Mm-hmm. Where would you go?
Actually, I'm looking at Dubai and Costa Rica and any number of places. Somewhere, well, someone might overlook the fact that I have made a mistake and will let me show them, as I have for the last 10 months working, let me show them that I can do this.
Well, I really appreciate you being so honest and open about your journey, and I think that a lot of people listening will also appreciate the roads that you've walked and what you've offered us today. So let's stay in touch, okay?
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
That was James Smith, who was recently laid off from a manufacturing job. He's now collecting unemployment and working to find work in Southern California. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. President-elect Obama names his national security team, and a new list says New Orleans has the worst crime rate in the country. So what are officials going to do about it, and what do locals need to help them feel like it's worth staying in the Big Easy? We've got these stories and more on today's Bloggers Roundtable with Anthony Bradley, creator of the Institute blog, Nashika Washington, who blogs at yourblackfriend.com, and Eric Brown, who blogs for the Detroit News. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi there.
So today it became official. People have been predicting for weeks that Barack Obama would pick Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State. Anthony, they fought down to the bone for the Democratic nomination, but now they're all smiles. Do you think they like each other, or that they've got each other's backs even?
Well, whether they like each other or not, they're certainly going to figure out a way to work together. I think that what we're seeing with Obama's choices is that he is building a centrist cabinet. These are fundamental individuals that have expertise in various areas. And the brilliant thing about the Clinton choice is it keeps her out of all the congressional bickering that's about to happen as the Democrats fight for territory. And it also keeps her out of the Demexit conversation. To keep her on a plane somewhere in Saudi Arabia actually gives him more of the platform. So this is actually brilliant and strategic, I think.
Nishika, when you think about the Senator Clinton move, I had a couple different conversations. One was, is it better to be a senator or the Secretary of State? So what do you think about the choice that she had to make, not that she's confirmed yet, but also now there's going to be this huge release of information from donors to President Clinton, Bill Clinton, that goes into the vetting of Senator Hillary Clinton. Do you think that we'll see any surprises there?
As far as the vetting process goes, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting because there's a lot of dirt, presumably, that's going to be uncovered. But I think it was a brilliant choice. And just to get to your other question, I do think he likes her. I think he respects her. And obviously appointing her to this position, it's powerful. Do I want to be a senator or do I want to be on a worldwide stage? Hillary is going to love being in this position. And I think she'll be good at it.
Eric, when you think about the attacks in Mumbai, that to me really crystallizes some of the challenges that this president is going to have. There are the questions of, for example, who's your ally? Just because you have supported someone in the past, if they are also harboring terrorists, how do you take action against them? What kinds of issues do you think this team is going to have to deal with as they step in and they're ready on day one, a phrase that got overused during the campaign?
Well, it's going to be interesting for one, because a lot of people like Barack Obama. A lot of people, so they say, likes Hillary Clinton, based on her former first lady status. And I think there will be definitely some pressures, but I think they will be able to coalesce a lot of the pressures that people perceive to be out there. And I think it's going to be a very successful 4 years, possibly 8 years for President-elect Barack Obama.
Now, I want to turn to New Orleans. You know, it's got, according to the CQ Press City Crime Rankings list, the highest crime rate in the nation. That's based on 19,000 reported crimes, which includes 209 murder cases in 2007. Anthony, let me start with you. New Orleans obviously still grappling with Hurricane Katrina. Many of the city's best and brightest have left. There are so many wonderful people left. Don't get me wrong, but I'm thinking of actually two people who I knew in college, who, because of a home invasion attack, the wife was shot and killed and the husband wounded, and he ran a free medical clinic. And so after that happened, they left, you know, the surviving husband and the child left. When you are talking about that kind of violence that can occur against anyone, what does the federal government, for example, owe to this city, which was so much of its misery tied up with the federal response or lack thereof?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the federal government has some responsibility to help restore order. There is a massive lack of the rule of law that's created a context for violence and New Orleans' reputation for corruption. And until government establishes the kind of context where you can have investment by business and also civil society, where intermediate institutions like churches and community groups can work together, it's going to be unattractive for those people who seek to go to New Orleans to have a better life.
Eric, if you had to put on your time-lapse imagination, what would you see happening to New Orleans over the next 5-10 years?
Well, to piggyback on what Anthony said, the American government has a great responsibility to restore order in New Orleans, because it would not be the way it is right now, though they had their problems prior to Hurricane Katrina. But a lot of the problems now, I feel, is a direct result of Katrina. And with that being said, looking 5 years to the future, there will have to be some type of situation or an initiative put forth by the government to change things around. That is a tourist city. If you want people to continue to come down there and visit the city, make it respectable. clean up the crime. And I'm not saying do whatever it takes to do that, but you're going to have to do something to put some things in place to make people even want to feel safe going there and living there again.
Nishika, there were times when, for example, you know, times in the past half century where tourists avoided New York City because they thought it was too dangerous. New Orleans has, the people who go to New Orleans often walk away with the sense of magic and mystery, or at least they did, you know, when they came to a city that really combined several different layers of history, the Spanish history, the French history, the Creole history, the American history, blues, jazz, on and on and on. But crime is really critical in terms of how people choose where to live and also where to visit.
Absolutely.
Do you think that with this kind of a crime problem, New Orleans can recover?
I'm not sure that New Orleans will recover to be the same kind of place that it was before, basically. And I'm not sure that the government has any vested interest in seeing that happen. You're talking about tourist dollars. That's a state issue. It's a local issue. And really, I don't think we should kid ourselves that New Orleans has always been on this list in the top five. I think if you look back historically, I can't guarantee it's top five, but I'm pretty sure as a city.
It certainly has been, you know, a decade ago, it was at the very top.
Yeah, now it's exacerbated as a result of Hurricane Katrina, but I don't know that you can say, oh, you know, the government has to come in now and restore order because they messed up in the first place.
But do you think that there are any ways, just to broaden it out a little bit, that when you have cities, whether it's Detroit or Baltimore, New Orleans, you have cities that are known for higher crime rates, but also have cultural value, of course, mm-hmm. that there are ways to be smart about how you can do policing or how you
Absolutely.
Can address those issues?
Absolutely. But again, those are more local issues. I mean, you talked about the corruption of the government there. I guess their superstar governor, Jindal, maybe he can have some kind of, I don't know, say about how things change. But hopefully it will be restored. New Orleans is a great place, but I'm not interested in visiting at this time because of the crime.
All right. Well, on that note, we are NPR's News and Notes. This is our Bloggers Roundtable, and you were just hearing the voice of Nishika Washington, who blogs at yourblackfriend.com. We've also got Anthony Bradley, creator of the Institute blog, and Eric Brown of the Detroit News. Eric, let me go to you. This has caused a lot of laughter, but it's a very serious issue. If you are the kind of person who is large enough to fit on two airline seats, should you be charged for one or two? The airlines, understandably wanting their money, are like, well, you got to pay for two. But the Canadian Supreme Court just ruled that people have a functional disability, that their obesity is a functional disability, and that's a legal term. And it's like one person, one fare. What do you think of that ruling? Eric?
The problem is, I agree with what the Canadian courts did, because when you're on an airplane, it's about comfort. And if I'm on a plane where I'm sitting, nothing against an obese person, but I want to be comfortable as well. And that person deserves to be just as comfortable. So if they could get to be able to sit in a seat or buy a seat for one person and they can occupy both seats, I think that's only fair. Because sometimes, if you're flying from New York to L.A. nonstop, that's a long flight. I've flown from Detroit to California, you know, 4.5-hour flight. I would hate to have been sitting next to an obese person because, you know, there are times where you may have to go to the bathroom. You got to ask that person to move. There are times where you just want to, you know, be comfortable yourself. So I applaud the Canadian court for doing what they're doing. It's only fair because it's fair to that person. They should not have to suffer based on, you know, if you want to look at a disability, some people will look at it as a disability. Some people will look at the person as being a circumstance of their own self. But still, it's only fair. Let them have two seats for the price of one.
Anthony, what about – I'll play the role of an airline executive. How do you expect us in these tough times to make any money when you got one person taking two seats but paying for one? How's that going to work?
Well, I would actually support you as an airline executive. The Center for Disease Control just did a study that came out recently. And just in America, with our 10% average increase in our weight, it's costing the airline industry an extra $275 million just for an average of 10% weight in increase in Americans because they have to use 350 million more gallons of fuel. Wow. And 3.8 million extra tons of carbon dioxide are released just to move larger people around the country. And the real issue is the economic one. We're talking about the spillover cost. The key question is, why do healthy people have to subsidize that extra $275 million a year that airlines have to spend in terms of revenue they don't receive from that empty seat? And that's really the core question.
Nishika, do you think needs to be done?
Well, just the whole issue, I think it's going to be interesting for them to figure out what determines whether or not you're obese. How much extra weight do you have to have? Is it your body mass index? Is it a hormonal issue? I mean, how are they going to be able to make that determination? I think it's going to be interesting to see how this gets worked out. It's one thing to say, yes, we have a policy, but it's another thing to see it put into effect.
That's interesting. Yeah, because there are clinical definitions of obesity, but it sounds like you're talking about what will the practical application of that be when it comes to applying this law.
Right, and then, of course, you've also
be a whole lot of measurements and stuff before people get on planes.
Well, Farai, let me interject for a second right quick, because if they're talking about BMI, that is so widespread, then the average person would be overweight.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, it's a huge issue, so to speak. All right, moving right along. Eric, you're going to be a panelist tomorrow for a forum for potential candidates to fill the remainder of Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick's term. Now, he pleaded guilty to two counts of obstructing justice by perjuring himself when he denied under oath an affair with his ex-chief of staff. Today, his ex-chief of staff, Christine Beatty, pleaded guilty to two felony obstruction of justice counts. Now, she's going to serve 4 months in jail, 5 years on probation. Eric, what is the expectation of what's going to unfold from both the replacement of Kilpatrick and the kind of Kilpatrick hangover?
Well, my expectation, and I hope it's the same expectation of the residents of Detroit, should center around character and integrity. Quit letting names be the precipice for you going to the ballot box to vote for someone, and just go to the ballot box in general. I mean, it's a shame that you had an election on November 4th and only 53% of the eligible voters in Detroit voted. If you feel that strong about your city, if you want your city to not be the laughing stock of the country, then go out and make a change, go out and make a difference by going to vote. So the key expectation for filling out the remainder of the term or the next election of the mayor come November of 2009 should be character and integrity. That's what the people should be looking for, because they went with the glamour candidate in 05 and, in 01, and look at where they got them.
That whole issue of voting when it's not sexy, you know, a lot of people have been talking about whether or not the people really this time around voted in large numbers because they liked Obama or because they were committed to the process. Do you think people are, in fact, Nishika, going to turn out and have their say?
In Detroit?
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully they will. I mean, I don't know if they're concerned about being a laughingstock, but I'd like to think that they would, but as evidenced by their last election and our general tendency, maybe. Who knows?
And then, I guess, Anthony, when I think about this, it's something where Kwame Kilpatrick called himself the hip-hop mayor. Is this going to prevent future mayors from taking on monikers like that and, mantles like that?
Absolutely. I actually hope so, because what Detroit needs is not necessarily a hip-hop mayor. They need a mayor who has the character and integrity, like Eric said, to get things done. Detroit is on the brink of a crisis if the auto industry goes down. And so they need a mayor who actually is probably not as glamorous, but someone who has the intelligence and the wherewithal to make really tough decisions and clean house so that the citizens of Detroit can rebuild that city.
All right.
Correct.
Guys, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking to Anthony Bradley, creator of the Institute blog. He joined us from KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri. Eric Brown, who blogs for the Detroit News, joined us from WYCD in Detroit, Michigan. And Ashika Washington, who blogs at yourblackfriend.com, was here in our studios at NPR West.
Since I said to you that we were through, just like a fool, I went away from home.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.